In a world where justice is supposed to be blind, there are those who believe the scales are tipped in favor of the powerful. The ones who are meant to protect us are often the ones who cause the most harm. The police force, sworn to serve and protect, have become a symbol of fear and mistrust for many. And the court system, designed to ensure justice for all, has failed time and time again. But there are those who refuse to be silenced, who fight for change, and who demand accountability. Join our host, former Texas police officer and major crimes detective, Justin Carlson, on a journey through the darkness, as he shines a light from his extensive 14 years of experience on police injustice and the failed court system. And as he speaks with the many others who have also experienced injustice, this is Failing Justice.
Welcome to the Failing Justice podcast. I am your host, as always, Justin Carlson. I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening. We are in downtown Dallas at Hello Studios. It's been a crazy week, crazy couple days with the weather, but I think it's starting to clear out. The weather is nice, though. It's real nice and breezy. We had the eclipse, the totality eclipse this week, which was super cool. And hope everybody got to take a peek at that. Something you don't get to see very often. So that was cool, but it's been a great week and glad to be back in the studio. It's been, Preston's not with us today. Preston has had, he had some meetings, and also he's welcoming a baby to his family on Monday. So he is trying to get prepared for that, and we miss him. We love having Preston here, but he is taking care of work things and family things, and we hope to get him back on the show here in a couple weeks. So y'all keep him in your thoughts and prayers. But I am excited. I have a guest here with me today, a former police officer from Georgia who made it to Texas somehow, and we're going to let him talk about that. But we have Austin Handel with us.
Yes.
And welcome to the show, man.
Well, I'm glad to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I met Austin through some mutual friends, through some private investigation work that we've been doing, and we kind of just connected because a lot of us that are doing these private investigations through this firm, we're all kind of former whistleblower cops and have experienced some form of, misconduct or corruption within our agencies, and we spoke out about it. And when Austin told me his story and kind of what he's done to advocate for whistleblower cops, I just knew that we had to have him come on the show. And so I'm super glad that he's here. Austin, what I want you to do, man, just introduce yourself to the audience, give a little bit about your background, where you worked, and then, I want to definitely transition into your story, kind of how you became a whistleblower, and, then we definitely want to talk about, he has a nonprofit, the Lamplighter Project, 501c3 nonprofit. So I definitely want to talk about that. But first, go ahead and introduce yourself and a little bit about your background.
Hey, so I'm Austin Handel. So I was a cop in Georgia. I originally started at a university police department before going to a larger agency, as many people do. And while I was at that larger agency, although I loved the city, I fell in love with it, I would even say, I very quickly started to see problems within our police force, but specifically with our leadership and with some bad commanders that eventually, and I can get into it in just a little bit, but eventually led to my termination. After trying to speak out, after going under back-to-back internal affairs investigations for things that either weren't policy violations or were totally unfounded, things that normally no officer would even like, it would never get elevated to a complaint like that. It would never get elevated to an internal affairs investigation. And in doing so, I had a final moment leading to my termination where I had a choice to make as to whether or not I was going to try to hang around, knowing that we had pending litigation and we had a lawsuit coming and we had a mountain of evidence of what was occurring at our police department. specifically with the Commanders, I held on. And so I allowed for the chief to fire me and to terminate me, one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my entire life.
Been there as of recently.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. It's not a good time, man. And so I had the opportunity, and I actually had, when I attended that last hearing, I had the letter on me to resign. If I wanted to turn it in during that meeting, I could have. I chose not to, assuming that when the chief of police received our evidence in our lawsuit, that it would be so clear, that it would be so evident that he would have to stop what was going on and start actually looking into the larger claims, because it involved several officers at our police department and a lot of misconduct, not just inside the police department, but also that the public was subjected to. And unfortunately, the person in question, a lieutenant that was the forefront of this corruption that revealed kind of an even deeper rooted corruption, I think, he was allowed to resign on a Friday. They paid him through the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, so he could clean out his office. And then on Monday, they drove to my house and terminated me Monday afternoon. I was on paid leave for probably over a month, just kind of waiting to see what was going to happen. But now it's been a whirlwind of almost 4 years now. We're actually coming up in May on the 4-year anniversary of my termination, fighting this corruption. We still have an active EEOC investigation into the city with 4 valid and active complaints by me and 3 other officers, one of which is a prisoner transport officer, so not sworn. But ever since then, man, I've just been advocating for others. I felt very lost when that all happened. I felt like I lost my identity. I lost everything that made me, and I had to figure out how to rebuild. And it's a very dark place for a lot of people. And so I never wanted people to feel subjected to that. And so when I did that, there was nowhere for anyone to go. There was no support group. There was no resources. There was no cop to talk to tell him your story and ask him if it was right, what happened to you. And I was reached out to by a lieutenant from a department up north, or someone that was an acting lieutenant. And he listened to me very candidly. He listened to my entire story. And what they ended up firing me for was accusing me of speeding in my patrol car in my neighborhood. saying I was untruthful for that. And we can get into that in a little bit, but you'll see that very quickly in every whistleblower case and in most cops that speak out against misconduct, typically untruthfulness is incorporated into that charge that they get rid of you with. And the reason they do that is because they want to find a way to try to discredit you later in court. And so even though it doesn't even actually mention the corruption and what we were trying to talk about and the stuff I was going through, let alone other officers, they included that in there saying I lied about speeding in my patrol car. And it led to a very long fight. But it led to just maybe 6 to 8 months ago, the chief of police in a hearing under oath actually admitting I didn't break a policy. I didn't break a single policy, and that includes the untruthfulness policy. And after that, I was able to finally at least win my unemployment benefits back, which the city spent over $100,000 trying to take away my $10,000 of unemployment benefits for 3 years.
So did they gave you unemployment? I guess they denied it in the beginning. And then so they recently, 8 months ago, they had to give you back pay for the unemployment?
Well, so it's similar to that. Close. So it was a crazy process. So what happens with the Department of Labor when you file is typically they do a claims examination and then they send someone to look at your initial claim. And typically that just includes a short statement from you and whatever the department submits. So a bunch of letterhead that says you're a bad person. And after that, I appealed it, went to a hearing. It was 2020 at this point. I was still very nervous. I was still very, I think I was still very broken and my voice was still very scattered. And so I tried to continue look, that's not the reason they fired me. This is not what happened. I didn't lie about speeding in my patrol car. And this is something bigger. And the hearing officer ruled in their favor. And at that point I had a pro bono attorney. I went to the next level, which is the Board of Review, appealed them. And for that one, I went a little cowboy-ish, speaking of Dallas. And I decided to, I wrote most of the brief myself. in the appeal. And I just had my lawyer look over it. And they overturned it.
Nice.
One of the things I wrote in there that was, I've heard, and to me is the most powerful statement. I know other people have used it since, and it has worked in their cases, was just because a police department puts it on an official police letterhead doesn't make it true.
I love, dude, that statement is so accurate and strong, because same thing happened to me. And just quick story, and we'll get back into yours. I went to apply at some other police departments. After I didn't even get fired the first time I left law enforcement. Literally, I left, started my own business, provided a 2-week notice, worked my 2-week notice. After that, the first time, not the second time, but the first time, I started Failing Justice. I started the organization, and I started talking about the corruption that happened within my department. Well, at that point, then they go put something in my file. Afterwards, I left clear, right? So they drum up all these lies about an investigation that I didn't complete, and you know, I was a detective, and I just let this victim suffer. I mean, it was ridiculous, all lies, because I have everything that I in my possession to completely disprove that. So I went to apply at another department, and in out in East Texas, it's a rural smaller area, and so like everybody. If you work in, like, say, you know, Palestine or Tyler or Bullard or Troop or ARP or whatever city, somebody knows somebody. And so the guy that was doing my background investigation at this department I applied for was friends with a detective where I previously worked, who was friends, good drinking buddies, with the police chief. Talking small town corruption, just crap. So he called me in and he said, "Hey, went over there and it looks like they have some stuff in your file. What's this about?" And he asked me about the case. And I said, "Well, this is what happened with the case." And I said, "What you're telling me," and he wouldn't show it to me. I said, "What you're telling me is a complete lie." I said, "Here's why they," and I got pretty passionate about it. And he was all like, "Oh, you need to calm down. I don't appreciate the way you're coming to me." I said, "Look, man, as I'm not coming at you," I said, "you know, I feel like you're accusing me. And you're agreeing with this piece of paper that you," he's like, "well, they got it documented." And so to your point, I told him, I said, anybody can document anything. Mm-hmm. I said, I can draw a picture of Mickey Mouse right now, hand it to you. You put it in that file and it's documented. I said, anybody can document anything. So just because somebody writes some words on a piece of paper does not mean that it's accurate and true. Mm-hmm. And so that was to your point. Like, the problem is people review these documents and they think because it's official that it's accurate. Well, and it's not.
And it's not official. And I think what happened in my case was, and a version I tell people that aren't in the space, that don't maybe fully understand law enforcement, is if I write on a sticky note that I didn't do it, and a police department writes on official police letterhead that I did,
yeah,
it has the same weight. It has the same exact evidentiary value. And so it doesn't matter. And they're more than welcome to present evidence. They're more than welcome to have maybe like a voice recording, a video, all these things, which they don't. And I was aware of that. I knew that at the time. They tried later on in hearings after that to try, and I'll get into that, to try to present something that they're like, because attorneys can, of course, say whatever when they're questioning you. And so they were like, "Well, did you know that was recorded?" And I was like, "Yes." I was like, "Because I assume so. Most police officers do record situations like that. I assume the lieutenant in question had recorded it. So to my best of my knowledge, if he did record it, that, yeah, I assumed he had. I had never heard the recording." And they didn't know what to do. Their attorney kind of froze after that because he didn't expect me to say that, because they just wanted me, if they said, "Oh, well, did you know it was recorded?" He thought it was going to break me, I guess. But going back to the story initially was so after that, I filed that brief, and all of a sudden I got a letter. I'll never forget when I received it. And at this point, I was really low in my trying to like recover from this. I had already debt was rising a little bit. I had taken out my retirement to help pay for some bills. At that time, I was 25, And so I was thankfully young enough that it wasn't like a total head turner to move in with my parents, who were first responders. But I had moved in with them, and I was staying in one of their bedrooms and just trying to figure out what to do, thinking that this was going to be over sometime soon and that I'd be back. And I got a letter, and it said that the Board of Review had overturned it in my favor. And I remember just immediately just breaking down.
That's amazing.
And I looked at my family, and I was like just shaking, because you really are an underdog when you speak out against the system. You truly are. And so as an underdog, like holding this, thinking at this point, like almost ready to give up, it was just the right time to give me the passion to keep going. So then the city filed a request for them to reconsider it. They denied it. Denied the request. And then
So the city wanted to appeal the appeal.
Mm-hmm. And at that, wow. And it's funny, because at that level, at the Board of Review level in most states, when you have an agency and administrative board, when it gets to that level, their decision is final. And they did have the ability to try to ask, but typically, I mean, it's rare that any board reverses their decision. So they filed the motion. Months go by. It gets denied. And then months go by, and then we receive in the mail, unexpectedly, I received a giant package from USPS, and it was 880 pages that they filed with the court, asking the court to overturn it for judicial review, saying that they had all this evidence and saying that their rights were violated because in the original hearing, they didn't have proper notice of the hearing. And there was some kind of issue where their address was wrong or something. And so they said, if our address had been right and we would have gotten notice, which we had plenty of, like, we tried to present evidence that they did receive it. They just didn't, you know, they were trying to find any reason. And they said, if we did have proper notice, we would have been able to present evidence in the hearing that we knew for sure would have changed this. And you guys would have seen, obviously, and ruled on our side. And this is a failure of the justice system. Which is, we're not even in the justice like venue right now talking about this.
Yeah, so, it's the civil legal system.
And it's wild because it was right after COVID. So everything's backed up. A year goes by, or almost a year, I guess. And we finally get a hearing. I was on traveling to Alaska backpacking at the time.
Hold up, 880 pages?
Oh, I have it. I have videos on my TikTok actually taking it places. I took it with me to Nashville. We went to the ice exhibit and I went down the ice slide with it. I swam with it in the pool. We took it.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's taxpayer money and they spent so much money.
And was it all BS?
Yeah,
it was all BS.
It was just reprinted documents over and over again of their own IA of what they submitted in the previous hearing. But finally it goes to judicial review and the judge rules. I can't rule on the merits of the case, but I can say that, you know, their address was wrong. And they should have received a little more notice. And so we're going to reopen it and knock it all the way back down to a hearing officer. So the city was like, this is it. You know, we got him now. And we all know that on the back end, whatever happens with this affects the EEOC investigation for me. It affects everything. Because if I win, now you have one government agency looking at all the documents, all the evidence, and saying that this was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if they win, that's at least admitting that there could be evidence that I was wrong. So months go by again, and all these emotions get drummed up and stuff. And we finally have the hearing almost 3 years later after I was terminated. And on the hearing is the chief, the new deputy chief, and a major who used to be a lieutenant.
And what agency was this?
This was the city of Dunwoody, so just north of Atlanta.
Okay.
We went to this hearing, and I was shocked that they showed up like that in full force like that. Like I had not heard this person's voice in forever. I had a reaction to that. Cause I was like, oh God, like they're all here.
I mean, it's probably an intimidation tactic too. I mean, let's be honest. And you know,
thankfully the hearing officer and my attorney, I had a new attorney at this point, was good enough to ask them to have only one person in the room at the time. It was over phone. Cause I was here in Texas already. And, we started the hearing. We got to the point where they were asking that major used to be lieutenant questions about, or asking me questions about him and asking about, well, you know, did you lie? And I'm no, you know, did you speed in your patrol car? I can't say that I never have, but I can say, like, I'm sure I have. I would imagine most police officers have. And, mm-hmm. the problem is the semantics of that they were trying to get me on. They just wanted me to
You're
nail.
Splitting hairs with these little questions.
Oh, yeah. And so they were like, well, you, did you know that that was recorded when you, you know, and they're like almost like at the level of like getting agitated with me. They're like, you know, stop doing that. Like, what's the, you know that this happened and when it's recorded, did you know that? And I thought, I guess I was going to break under pressure. And so I said, yeah. And they're like, well, final question. And the hearing officer had to stop them because like, you can't talk to him like that. Mm. And the hearing officer, the final question they had for me was, do you know a single other person at the police department that lied and kept their job? And because the whole idea was the chief Billy Grogan, wanted to get everyone to believe.
Yeah, he's in this room.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah, for real. And his ego is big enough to be. But he wanted everyone to believe that he has a policy, a good old, he almost sounds like an old granddad. He has a rule that if you work for him and you're a liar, you're found to be untruthful about anything, you can't work for him anymore. So my answer was yes. And the attorney got mad and was like, that's a lie. And the hearing officer had to cut him off and let him finish. You asked him the question. And I said, well, yeah, the person that's sitting right next to you, the major.
There you go.
I said, in my evidence on page 11, I said, I submitted an internal affairs investigation where the previous deputy chief said he lied when filing a complaint on a different officer. And so they had no further questions. It went forward. That was the only evidence they said that they had, the evidence that was going to overturn everything. They didn't have anything else. They just wanted to delay it. They wanted it to cost me as much money as possible. They're using taxpayer money.
Yeah, to pay their lawyers and golly.
So it got reversed in my favor and then, they upheld the reversal from the Board of Review. Then it went to the Board of Review again and then they begged the Board of Review and said that it's enough is enough. I'll never forget that line. Enough is enough. It's time for them to rectify their, how they're abusing the city of Dunwoody by letting me keep my 10 grand of unemployment benefits, because obviously I should have been fired. The Board of Review said, well, two things. One, we did everything by the book because they were accusing them of not doing it by the book. And two, we also, after reviewing everything again, still agreed that he should have his unemployment benefits. And then they gave up. They didn't do the next motion for reconsideration because they did have that open to them one more time. But that's because we were also in the news a lot. Something I didn't say when I started with my introduction was when I first spoke out, I didn't know what else to do. But thankfully, and I know a lot of cops are going to be a little cringe to this, but when I was a cop at this time, I had like maybe 10,000 followers on TikTok. I wasn't posting anything crazy. I wasn't even posting often. And this is in like 2020, so it's before like cops saturated TikTok. Mm-hmm. And so when it all happened, they drove to my house and took my gun and badge and said I was speeding in my patrol car. I posted to TikTok and I said, because at that point I had already heard about the other corruption that was going on inside the department and how the lieutenant had been sexually targeting and harassing officers in our department, but possibly also children in our community. And so I was like, I don't know what else to do. I felt like I was fighting such an uphill battle. I posted to TikTok and it went viral. And I remember
that was the day that they fired you.
That was the day they put me under IA.
Under IA, okay.
And that was after like two other IAs that were found to be.
So you were still employed when you made the TikTok.
When I finally made that one, I didn't know what else to do.
And boy,
they never brought it up after that. They never brought it up after that. But I knew that that was exactly where it was coming from. But I also had heard, and it wasn't until I got a call from somebody at the department that said they were going to fire me before I ever even went in for the IA, that he was talking to the lieutenant and they were trying to fix something on one of the cars. Found out later. It was my car that they had taken from my house that they were trying to do something to it. And while he was talking to this other whistleblower, Brian Bolden, while he was talking to him, he said, yeah, we're about to fire that kid Handel. And so that's before I even went in. And so I was like, I'm done. Like, they're going to fire me regardless. So I was like, I don't know. You know what? Let's just put it out there because I don't know what else to do. And this is wrong because what they were doing was so much worse. And we had evidence at that time that they knew about it and they weren't doing anything about it. So
I want to ask you a question before we continue. You give me your opinion on this. I tell cops all the time, whenever they come to me and they ask, what do I do? This is the situation, whistleblower situation. I say, and this is my opinion, and you tell me what you think. We can have open and honest dialogue. I tell people all the time, cops, whenever you're experiencing misconduct, corruption, and it's a true whistleblower situation, I have always found it, because anytime, and I'm not saying you can't blanket this, you can't say this is the same all over, because clearly it's not, but in my experience, anytime I have trusted the process that's in place, well, I think I'm going to tell this person and they're going to do what's right, because we're cops. We are supposed to have integrity. We're supposed to do what's right. So I'm going to trust the process that it's going to go through and things are going to get handled. In my experience, that has never been the case. And I've gone through it at two different departments on a major level. And I tell people, I say, you are more protected by taking this public, right? Because the problem is, and it's just like the criminal legal system, the criminal justice system, whenever you have somebody who's been arrested for a crime, say that they didn't commit, and then you get them a court-appointed attorney, and they're limited on how much of their case they can work because of county funding or whatever, and then they just say, well, you need to accept the plea deal. It's kind of equivalent to that, because it's like, if I go to the administration or to my superiors, I don't trust that they're going to take care of this the way that they should. And in my experience, I mean, I'm even going through it right now. In my experience, taking things public so that way they can't hide it. If you have facts and you're putting it public, there's nothing they can do to negate those facts. And so my question is, do you think that that's accurate, going public with some things sometimes? Because, you know, I feel like if you do it internally, it just gets covered up. And that's been my experience.
Well, and I can say also with the project working across the country, like we've served whistleblowers, and we call them lamplighters, but we've served lamplighters in over 20 states. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but we have heard cases of all kinds, from sexual harassment to sexual assault, of someone inside the department assaulting an officer. And then when that person reports it, they get arrested. So like one of my favorite stories I talk about, and I know her story is public, so I can say her first name, but Erica reached out to me when I first spoke out. And that's what another kind of origin story to the Lamplighter Project. And she was up in a small department in Ohio, and she was sexually assaulted by a detective at a police function. And when she reported it, they, amongst like all a bunch of other small stuff, like weird political semantics, it was a very small, like seasonal police department. When she reported it, they ended up arresting her, saying she violated her oath of office, and she almost faced years in prison. And so
arrested her for what? What was the?
She broke her oath by lying. But she never lied, and so she fought it. And she did get progress, and she did win. That process was a little faster for her, and I was very happy to see that for her. But that's just one case. And I find that, like, and that's a sexual assault. That's a very personal, like a misconduct on a personal level versus, like, widespread corruption. But the widespread corruption is elements of it all. And so I think as officers really look, and leaders, as they look at their police departments and look at the structure, they'll very quickly realize there is no system actually in place, no matter – we have a case with IAB, the Internal Affairs Bureau, out of the NYPD. So like you can have the most robust policy and just hundreds of pages. There's no system in place to protect anybody or where they can intervene on your behalf to prevent misconduct happening to like a junior officer. And so like in my case, and I hear this with others, a lot of times mid-level managers are not the problem. A lot of times like a shift supervisor or a lieutenant maybe actually isn't the problem. They could even be trying to protect an officer from the command structure. And the fact that that's a problem is very concerning.
Right.
Because anytime that someone tries to go to HR at their local city or county, it gets bumped away or bumped back down to their to them. They're like, well, you're not cops. We're cops. We'll handle it. We have an internal affairs system. And so going to HR with your local government doesn't help, or the larger entity that you work for. So they bump it back to the police department. So anything you told HR pretty much gets released over anyway. And then you wind up in a system where they're, you know, now you're sitting here with the people you're accusing of being corrupt. You don't know, possibly in some cases, you don't know who's connected to who, who's friends with who.
And there's always a connection.
There's always a connection.
Of some sort.
Because, and the cops know that. Cops know that there's a connection inside the department, because all the time, when you go to an agency next door, they're best friends with like the lieutenant or the captain next door. So to imagine that that's not happening internally is also like just a red flag. Obviously, as a cop, you should know better. But I think you wind up in this space where, like, for me, my supervisors tried very hard to protect me. My sergeants tried very hard. We had a very flat organization at our department. We had officers, sergeants, lieutenants, majors, deputy chief, and chief. And that was on purpose. It was a younger department. We still had under 100 officers, but still not tiny. And we formed out of a section of Atlanta years ago. And so this department got this messed up in like 10 years. Like at that point, it was only 10 years old. And it got this messed up. So imagine those departments that are like 100 years old or so or longer, right? So like the 10 years it took for us to get this messed up, for the system to not be in place to protect us. It was a new system. It was a system where they weren't doing the FTO program. They were doing the PTO program.
PTO.
Yeah. And so like they were like, we're so forward thinking. They were big on social media. And like my supervisor had to text me if the lieutenant physically saw me. He would text me and say, hey, don't come by the PD to pick up your gear at the beginning of shift because the lieutenant's here, because if he physically saw me, I would be written up for something. And that is an anxiety for a young officer to have for years. And it, like, it got to the point where like, I was like, oh my God, like, is he there? Is he not? And also like administratively, that's a huge problem, because now I'm not picking up my less lethal shotgun at the beginning of my shift. I'm not getting like all the gear I need, and then I have to go by the PD later, and I could be on calls. And it just got to such a point, but that's all they could do, was put themselves in the middle. And it got to a point where they were getting on to my sergeant now, and like for other miscellaneous things that weren't policy violations, just giving him a hard time. And so I ended up swapping to a new supervisor who was also a really good dude. And he tried to protect me as long as he could, but that only lasts so long. And I had gone to both of them and told them what I was going through. And they both like just said, hey, like, just keep your head down, like, you know, fly under the radar as much as you can. And they helped me with that, but it wouldn't come out until later, like when I had one sign an affidavit actually admitting that, yes, I did come to them about this. I did say this and stuff, but because the city tried to deny it. So
were they, did anything ever happen to them? Did they have any adverse?
So one left and went to a larger agency that was paying better. And then he worked his way all the way. He went down from sergeant to be an officer at a higher paying agency that had just gotten a raise. And he left, I think, as a major over there. And that was nice. Crazy for him. And then he went into the private sector. And then the other one went on to a few cities over, and he's a lieutenant there. But I think speaking to that, it speaks to such a larger concept, which is like my entire shift in a matter of a year or two left the city. So commanders think that when they do things like this to officers, that like they can just get away with it. They
just
do it. And like, there's no adverse impact.
Just get rid of them. They'll go somewhere else. Which brings me to my next question for you. There's probably a lot of different answers, but for you specifically, what was it that was in you that made you say, okay, like I am going to fight this, like I am, because here's the truth. The truth is, it's easier not to fight it, man. It is so much easier on all sorts of fronts, especially your mental health, to just say, look, I'm not going to worry with this. I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to move on. What was it that was within you that said, hey, I'm not going to let this go. I'm going to fight this head on, full force, no matter what.
So a lot of times people think it's just that, and I don't think you feel this way, but a lot of times people think it's as simple as, oh, you just made a choice and you're like, you know what, no matter what, I'm going to do this thing. And that was never the case. When I first posted that first TikTok video before my IA hearing, I moved it from public to private setting like 3 times in one day. I had so much anxiety about it. I was like, this is it. I don't know what's going to happen. Like now I'm really, obviously, and I know everyone would agree, like that's, well, now they're really going to come after you. And it's like, well, yeah. But I was like, I don't know what else to do. And when I started to see the mountains, the actual evidence, like I already seen some of it, when I started to realize how bad it was from the other whistleblowers, when I started to see it, I was like, we can't let this thing go. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't days I woke up and I just wanted to give up. Like when I lost those hearings, there's plenty of times I was like, I don't have an identity. I don't know what I'm going to do now. My degree was in criminology, I have my bachelor's degree in criminology. And so I was like, what do I do? I have to reinvent my entire who I am. And I like can't just,
they try to destroy your credibility. They try to take away your integrity. And so who else is going to hire you?
Exactly. And that was the problem, was because no matter what you tell another agency, they're going to look at these documents and say, oh no, you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And of course, when they're getting those documents from them, they'll like maybe wind up on a phone call, be like, oh, that guy's not someone you want.
Under the table conversation. Yep. That shouldn't be happening, but we all know that it happens.
And there's other impacts that people endure that go through that stuff like that for me. But I'll say that like for me, and I'm no stranger to talking about this because I think it's important. There was a point where like, I was like really in a bad space with my mental health. And I was like, I just felt so lost. And I, even though like the videos were going on TikTok a little bit, I felt like I was like at least fighting a little bit. And I was like, maybe making a little bit of a difference. Within like a couple weeks, I was like, I just want to like not be here. And thankfully I never acted on that, but I chose to go to bed like the night that I was really feeling that way. And I was like, maybe tomorrow will be a better day. And I woke up and I was just like, you know what, man, I'm just going to see this thing through. I was like, I'm going to see it all the way through. And there was plenty of times I woke up and I was like, man, this is tiring for me, my family, my friends, this is tiring. And I feel for them, especially because like having to see me post about it all the time and talk about it, like it seems all consuming and it's not. But what I tell every whistleblower I talk to when they ask me a similar question is, you don't have to fight every day. You just have to fight on the days that it matters.
Yep.
And on the other days, take a rest, take a break, find something, reinvent yourself, find a hobby, start somewhere. Go start walking outside, you know, especially if you were a night shift officer, get outside and see the sun. You probably haven't seen it in a while, but like go out there and just really, truly like just keep moving. And that's all you need to do is keep moving, because when that day comes to fight, you'll be able to fight.
So man, there's so many cops out here, you know, we talked about this the other day, when we were working together, if the public really knew, right, what was happening, you know, because what you see on the news, you see this police officer was stealing time, or this police officer was asleep in his car, or this police officer got a DWI, like this police officer violated somebody's constitutional rights, and you see all these things. And I'm not saying every one of them, I'm not excusing it is what I'm saying. But what I am saying is the stress and the mental anguish that takes place within the walls of these police departments around this country, and probably the world. I mean, it's probably the same way in other countries, but specifically speaking within this country, it is at such an all-time high. And these officers find outlets, unhealthy outlets, right? I mean, alcohol, you know, pornography, sex, whatever the case may be, they find these outlets. And man, it destroys their life. And I'm not, man, we all make decisions. We all can, you know, at the end of the day, we all make the decision. And I don't want it to sound like I'm making an excuse. My point is just that the public, they don't understand what takes place within these police departments. They don't understand that there are actually good cops like yourself who experience extreme misconduct and corruption. And because you stood up for it and you said, look, this isn't right. This isn't why I raised my right hand and took this oath. This isn't okay. And this is happening within. So it's even more not okay. And there are so many out there that are like that, man. people I know right now, friends of mine that are going through things and they're afraid to speak up because that's their livelihood. They have kids, they have family to feed, they have bills, car payments to make, mortgages. And that's what these administrators and these superiors and these bureaucrats within the city, they know that they got you. And that you're not going to say anything if you want to keep your job. And then if you do say something, they're going to find a reason to discredit you. They're going to put it on paper, and then you're screwed when you want to try and go somewhere else.
Well, and so that's the thing. You're not allowed to have a dissenting opinion, and you're not allowed to have your own ideas. And it, something that I think you and I talked about the other day is like with the younger generation of police officers and policing, they are prone to ask questions. And it's not because that they are unprofessional and they just haven't learned how to be a cop yet. It's because that's a token part of their generation in society. They right. ask questions. They go, well, why are we doing that? And a lot of people, especially the oldest generation that are still working of police officers, you weren't allowed to even think that you could like question why you're doing something until you got to those upper command levels, which is why they strived so hard to get there. They're like, when I get there, I'll get to make the decisions. But they forgot who they were along the process.
Yep.
And so when they get up there, they're like, you know, I'm going to be better, but I'm never, but like they never become, it's kind of like the son and the father situation where they're like, I'm going to be better than my dad was, that some people feel. And then they get up to that level and they're like, well, I do have some of the same failures, but I am a better version. And so they're like, well, I'm not perfect, but I'm better. And so they think they're doing the right thing because they've been doing this for 20 years. But the most younger generation of police officers is the most current iteration of society. And so that is something that the public is going to do. So when you pull over someone that maybe is the same age as that police officer, they're going to ask you why. They're going to tell yeah. and you actually, whether you realize it or not, probably should. It's probably beneficial to talk to them and explain the process. And so
you can tell the difference, but you know, you see these videos on YouTube, I'll just say it. Sheriff Lamb follows me, and so it's nothing against him, but they have the Pinal County in Nevada, the Pinal County Sheriff's Office. They have that guy, I can't remember his name, but they have he has the YouTube channel. He makes all these traffic stops, and people say when he pulls them over here, they'll say, you know, why did you stop me? And he'll be like, I'll tell you as soon as you give me a driver's license. Well, why did you stop me? I'll tell you as soon as you give me a driver's license. Well, why can't you tell me why you stopped me? Listen, if you don't give me your driver's license, I'm going to remove you from this car. Like, it doesn't, you can tell that's the old school mentality. There's nothing wrong with people asking those questions. Nothing wrong at all. And even if somebody asks it, maybe a little off balance, you know, maybe even a little aggressive. It's about controlling your inner ego and your pride and just answering the question, man, because there's been so many cases. We covered one on this podcast not too long ago of a traffic stop where a man ended up dead. And I believe it was all because of the initial response of the police officer. And so you're right. I mean, it is these officers, they, you know, it's the generation.
Yeah. And I like, again, I just think that it's something that it's not going anywhere, and it's getting, and to be fair, it's probably getting a little worse when it comes to asking questions. Cause like it's becoming even more and more for the even younger generation. They're asking even more questions, and those people will enter the workforce and they're not going to stop asking questions when they do. And they're not, when they become 16, they start driving and you're most likely going to pull them over or something. They're probably going to ask questions if they're not obviously like hysterical, but they're going to ask questions. And actually, you know, it's not that necessarily that they deserve an answer. It's that you should give them one. You right. should tell them, and you should also educate them on the process, because that is part of your job, is maybe not in your job description, but part of your job is also to help people understand what's going to happen to them, not just to subject them to the justice system, but to also help them to understand like what the next step is. And by doing that, you can actually change someone's life. It reminds me of a traffic stop for me where I pulled someone over. He was dealing, he was selling weed. And so we pulled him over and this is years ago. And so we took him to jail, and on the way there, normally, and at that point, I think I was coming from the other agency. So I had a training officer riding with me just, on the PTO program. And, he, on the way there, I talked to him. I said, yeah, man, do you have any questions? Is there anything I can explain to you? Like, or do you just want to listen to music? Like, whatever. And I just talked to him about things that were just still very professional, but whatever, like, was going to help make him more comfortable. And one of those things I said to him when we were done after talking was, he said, you know, you're the first cop to actually ever answer my questions. And I said, well, you know, it sounds like today is the first day of the rest of your life. And so I ended up pulling him over again for not using his turn signal, which of course is an obvious one, and just the most common. And, he saw me and he looked at me and he goes, oh my God. He's like, I don't even care if you give me a ticket. He was like, you saved my life. Cause now he's like, when you pulled me over last time I was dealing, when you pulled me over tonight, I was leaving acting school. And I was just blown away. And the difference,
that's pretty amazing.
The difference in that, I know cops have a million stories like that, but the difference in doing that was just, all I did was just talk to the dude and treat him like he was a person and not treat him like it was just someone in the system. And so I think that when we have this mentality, it obviously, going back to the original discussion, is when we have this mentality that, like, you're not, no one's allowed to ask you a question and you're not, and you don't have to give them an answer, we get nowhere. And that's exactly what happens inside departments. Cause to your point and your initial question, if this is what they're doing to us, imagine how they're treating the public. Mm. And something that happened in my case was, I had too many positive compliments. I'll never forget this one. It didn't go all the way to an IA because they couldn't find anything on it. They said that I got called in the parking lot one night and they just let me know. They said, hey, we have to let you know technically that we've been looking into your file. And, we thought, because they were just watching, because I had compliments, like citizens could go on the website and fill out a compliment, like, this officer was super nice or whatever. They said that I had so many that they thought they had to be fake. And so they went and they spent department resources, time. Oh, they drove, gosh, to people's houses to find out that they were real. And then they went and they just had to notify me, like, in person. They're like, we're not going to put it on paper. And I was like, at the time, because I was just going through it and I was still working there, it wasn't before all the crazy stuff. Like, it was just starting to get like that. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's, you know, that's good. Like, it's still weird, but that's good. Like, but come to find out, like, I mean, like, here I was having, just for being too nice to people. Like, and that, and the issue wasn't, like, and a lot of older officers, I think, sometimes will contest and they'll be like, well, you weren't, like, doing, you weren't arresting, you weren't whatever. It's like, check the stats. I still was at the top of that board when it came to, like, actually, so for me to have the most compliments and me still to have the most incident reports, the most accident reports, or in the top three, at least in our department, and still have high arrests, high citations, high traffic stops.
It is possible if you get out there and do your job.
And I never had to tase a soul. And they were comparing me to, like, someone else at our department who was involved in the scandal at our department. And he was on the other side of it. And he, we had, like, similar arrest numbers, all that stuff, but he tased someone, like, once a month, and I never in my career had to tase a soul. And so it just speaks to the fact that there's a real disparity in how we treat the public and how we treat people. And that includes inside departments. We don't treat each other well. We call each other brothers and sisters, but we don't actually take care of each other very well. And that's something, as a family, we all have to sit down and go, hey, that's something we can fix, because the reality is there is no system in place for someone to speak up and for them to be, and to feel actually truly safe.
Well, you said it. And I've talked about it before. It is the absolute truth. If officers are being treated, not just unfairly, but if there's some real gross misconduct, unethical behavior, corruption, and you come out and say something about it, and then you are attacked, and they put on paper that you're a liar, you can't go anywhere else. If officers are getting treated that way because they are stepping up and saying, this is not right, this is not okay, this behavior shouldn't be happening within a law enforcement organization, and if they're getting tossed under the bus, you said it, what in the world is happening to the public, those that are getting arrested, that are getting cases, that are getting investigated? And I've seen it. We've had multiple on our show, exonerees, man, people who did 16 years for a murder they didn't commit. somebody who did 26 years for a sexual assault. That is what's happening. And the system is just so jam-packed full of that nobody is lending a hand and nobody is taking the time to care about those people. And so I want people to know that listen to this show, and that's why I wanted you to come on, is, you know, there are a lot of bad cops out there, fact, but there's also a lot of good cops out there that, man, not only do they have to deal with the stress of the actual job, you know, not only do they have to go out here and respond to, you know, sexual assaults or family violence cases or shootings or people mangled in car wrecks, not only do they have to deal with that, when they go back to the police department, it made me think of what you said about not going to the police department, wanting to avoid it. They have to go to the PD or the sheriff, wherever they're working, and they have to type the report, and they have to be, not only did they just deal with a traumatic event, but they have to walk into an office full of just total toxicity, and they have to deal with that. And then they go home. No wonder they get in fights with their spouse, mm-hmm. or, you know, pick up the tequila bottle and start drinking it. I mean, because, and there's got to be, at some point, we have to have a pendulum change, because, like, at some point that has to change. And to our conversation the other day, it's in a very unpopular opinion, I think. I think a lot of it has to do with the old school mentality, policing, and how the old school cops, we're talking those with, you know, 20, 25, 30 years, even 15 years, how they lead or manage, how they treat their officers. At some point, it's all got to change, because we are never going to move. Nothing is ever going to improve the direction that we're headed. Right. And I think you're also right with the newer generation coming in. You know, you are a product as a police officer of your training. And if you get in the car with an FTO who is carrying, you know, whose heart and mind is shifted in the right direction, and they're there to do the right thing and at the right time for the right reasons, when you encounter that as a trainee, I think there is more, there's more chance of success, right? But to me, it's the older school mentality, that it's that brick wall that these officers meet, and it's like, you gotta knock it down, man. You gotta knock it down, and you gotta have change.
Well, this will probably
help. I know I said a lot, but
no, it's good. This will help to go back into, I think, a little bit more about Dunwoody, just because of it connects to all of this, which is, like, when we were with USA Today, and so for the listeners, yeah, that my TikTok, like, blew up. I wound up, even though I was still going through it, I wound up, like, being on the news. I traveled the country. I wound up on the radio, and I called in from Ohio, like, mid-hike, and I was on the radio in Atlanta. And then I wound up helping USA Today to put together the Behind the Blue Wall series, and wound up on one of the, well, I say covers, but cover sheets. It was like the second page, me and Brian. But we were in that series. We were on USA Today, printed around the country. And, like, when it all first happened, it was, if you would have told me that at 25, that would have been happening to me. If you would have told me that when I was, like, last year, this past July or June, I went to Washington, D.C. and to National Whistleblower Day, and I got to speak inside the Senate building. If you would have told me I was doing that at 25, I would have told you you're crazy. I would have been like, there's no way. Like, I just want to be a cop. I just want to do my job. Yeah. And speaking to your own point, supervisors that are good, if you have an FTO or a training officer that's really caring, that's there for the right reasons, it was people like that and, like, my supervisors that took care of me that made me want to fight, because it was like, you know what? There is good in this profession, and it is littered with good. Like, I mean, I would argue that most cops are good, mm-hmm. until they are forced to be otherwise. And that sometimes is by a system as well. And I think that what happens is that most people inherently get into the job for the right reason, but they can very quickly fall victim to, you know, to their own personality failures or traits, or maybe not self-development work they haven't done, realizing their own traumas. And so it just creates such a system where, like, if there is negative, if there is a commander up there that is, you know, very dominating on these people, that wants it to be a certain way and wants, you know, and especially if he's doing some illegal stuff, it leads to a system that is broken. One of the first times I spoke to the news, I'll never forget it, and we talk about it often, I told the news that, I said the same thing. I said, well, you know, like, they're like, well, why is this so important? I was like, well, if this is what they're doing to us, then what are they doing to the public? And at that point, I didn't fully like know how to talk to the news. Mm-hmm. I didn't like fully like know what I was doing. And I'll never forget the headline on that article. It said, self-proclaimed whistleblower. And I...
Self-proclaimed.
And now a lot of reporters laugh at that when I talk to them, because they're like, well, first off, that doesn't even make sense. And she ended up leaving that newspaper agency. But I learned really quickly that the city was running circles around me in the news. Like I was always trying to be on the defensive, not on the offensive. I was trying to like protect me and my career and my identity that I didn't have anymore. And then I learned along the way how to fight back. And it was the most visceral thing I could do. And it was just tell the truth, tell it fast, and tell it accurately. And tell it candidly.
Right.
Be yourself. Don't be afraid of like it's okay to like miss, like you don't have to be exactly accurate. Police departments, you know, like in your reports you should be, but like you can misstep a little bit when you're telling the story, but you like just need to be honest with yourself and be like, you know, this is how I feel about this. You're allowed to do that. And so what happened with the city was they were never prepared. And remember, the city was big on social media. The police chief literally sold courses on how like police and got awards for how police should use social media. And he was never prepared for like a young officer just to like go viral on TikTok. And it literally changed everything. I'll never forget when I got the call that when someone at the department said that the police chief in an internal meeting said that they were under attack from TikTok. And I was just so happy inside. And I was like, well, good. You know, at least they're a little stressed about it because they should be, they're doing wrong. And they were committing crimes. And then that's when it just got so weird, because through TikTok, by doing that, by telling the truth, by being willing to be open in public, was when I started getting reached out to by members of the community telling me that the lieutenant had, that they were aware of, or that the lieutenant had targeted their children, or that they knew somebody that was targeted by the lieutenant. And that was insane. And had the chief have actually investigated the matter, he would have actually found that. But instead, after the chief was named in our lawsuit, he chose to, and after we asked him to bring in the GBI to investigate, he said no. This is a recorded conversation. He said no, got up and left the room, led to him releasing over 100-page report about how all of the sexual misconduct between officers inside the department, male officers and a male lieutenant, some of which were married, how it was all consensual and how it was totally fine. There was nothing else going on. Left out the kids part also. But again, that wasn't in the initial evidence we sent to them. But let me just ask you a question. Yeah. As an officer, if you have, and you have a wife or a partner, whatever, and whoever your significant other is, and they receive a text from your lieutenant, so not your sergeant, so your boss's boss, your supervisor's supervisor, and it says, do you eat his ass as well as I do?
Mm.
Tell me it's consensual, because I'll like, and actually prove it to me, because you learn in the, not just that, but in the military, you learn in police work, you learn in your annual training that if you're in a position of authority, and in some states, the law is written this way. If you're in a position of authority, that is sexual harassment. When you're in a position of authority and you're exerting that onto someone else, because at what point would an officer that was subjected to that, and I'll pause to say, I did not receive that text message. I was the only one that was not involved in the sex scandal, both me and Brian Bolden. But we found out about it, and because we were being targeted because we weren't in their weird sex scandal. So, and they wanted to bring more people in, and we have text messages that show that. But that's what was so insane, is that like, if you are sitting here and your wife is getting a message like that, like at what point would that officer...
Unsolicited.
At what point would that officer say, you know what, this is a consensual relationship and I no longer want to do this with you, and I don't like you texting my wife, and I'm not going to be a part of it anymore. It's not going to happen. And here's the other issue. He was writing commendations for people that were sending him like nudes and all kinds of stuff. He was taking photos of officers as they were using the bathroom over the urinal. But the chief releases a report, says it's consensual. And on top of that, he did it as a press release to all nearby news agencies and released the nudes of the officers and just blurred out their faces.
He released the nudes?
He did.
Saying and what? Like
saying it was all consensual. It was all consensual. And it obviously it's not a good look because here's the problem. He was named in the lawsuit before the investigation started. So he was a stakeholder in the outcome because if they actually investigated it, if they actually would have brought in the GBI and looked at it, they would have realized, oh my God. And it wasn't until throughout the years of doing this, fighting back against them, wow, that we found out, even a reporter told me that she was aware of somebody that actually saw the lieutenant send photos of himself to a child and that they brought it to the department and that the chief was aware of it. So tell me how someone that is supposedly speeding in their patrol car gets fired. And this guy used to be over the Explorers program. And so
that's mind blowing.
It is, but it speaks. And I always think about my story that it's such a weird one. Cause I wasn't in their scandal. I was just someone that didn't want to be. I'm straight. So, but I was never in their scandal. I had a girlfriend at the time. They were targeting me for literally like wearing a hat indoors, which isn't a policy, by the way. They said that you can only wear a hat when it was like raining or something outside. And I was wearing it.
They needed you gone.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, that's when you're a problem or a perceived problem, they need you out.
Well, and let me blow your mind for a second, which is, I'll also say one thing they made me do was they made me clean a carpet on my hands and knees in the middle of the night saying it left a stain on it. But, and I was such a young officer. I was so scared of them at the time that I was like, okay, like whatever. Like I was getting so much crap at the time. I was just like, whatever. But let me blow your mind with this. One of the majors at the department, who's always been a major at the department, he resigned from his last police department. He was at the city of Douglasville in Georgia before this. He was deputy chief there. He was found in possession of 50 firearms taken out of the evidence locker and a pair of brass knuckles and I think some cash, I think. And when they asked him, they said, well, why do you have this stuff taken out of the evidence locker? He said, I was going to make a gun memorial for the police department. Which is the dumbest excuse I've ever heard in my life, and I hope he hears that. But that guy, as far as I know, and this was a rumor at the department, but as far as I know, and I'm pretty sure it's true, but I'm guessing, he did not have access to the firearms locker at Dunwoody because of his past. They were aware of it, but they hired him, and he was the major.
So they hired him knowing...
Yeah, that happened before, and he's been the major. He's still the major. His name is Major Oliver Fladrick, and he... Is still the major.
Still employed.
Yeah, still employed. He's probably...
So did he not get indicted for the whole...
Well, no, because he resigned and it was an internal investigation, not criminal. And so, yeah. So it just... And that's the issue is that when you look at investigations against high-level commanders versus officers, it is totally different.
Oh, dude, totally different. Mm-hmm. That's what occurred at my previous agency, Pilot Point, as of recent. There was a female officer that made a sexual harassment complaint against Police Chief Rex Marks, and they went in and said, well, the finance director who heard the chief speaking on this female officer's sex life inaccurately, one, you shouldn't have been speaking on it, but two, it was inaccurate. Finance director heard it. Finance director goes and tells a police employee, says, hey, the chief was up in the city manager's office talking about her sex life, saying that the reason one officer left was because they were having sex and cheating on each other's spouses. I just kind of find that to be a problem. So when that was complained on and during the investigation, they said, oh, well, the city manager doesn't recall the conversation. And also the finance director, it's not credible. And during this whole investigation, the chief was allowed to he wasn't put on admin leave. We were in a tiny, we're in a 10-man department, super tiny, my last department was. We're in a 10-man department. This guy is showing up every single day, walking by the female officer's office and was like, hey, how's it going? Stepping in the, just intimidation. And they didn't put him on leave. So you're right. But you know what? Had that been me, Had I had a sexual harassment complaint, they'd have put me on leave and swiftly. This investigation took 8 weeks into the chief. 8 weeks. Had that been me, they'd have put me on internal affairs investigation, sent me home, and probably had that bad boy wrapped up within 2 weeks, and I would have been gone. So you're right. It's totally different when investigation of superiors rather than just the slick sleeve patrol officer.
I just got to go back to the fact that the finance director is not credible, but they're in charge of the finances. So like
that was my whole point. I was, you know, when they said that, I was like, what do you mean they're not credible? And they say, oh, well, just and mind you, this was like in mid to late 70s, third party HR consultant, because we didn't have an HR director at the time. So they hired a consulting firm who they'd already paid out several thousands of dollars anyway for doing consulting work. So they already had a relationship. The mid-70s, the late 70s HR consultant said, well, it was just her body language. She wasn't real clear. And the police chief, when he was asked about it, he was very direct. There was no stuttering. He in his body language, it was just a very clear, concise answer.
Yeah, probably because he's the chief.
And I'm like, well, you know, this isn't the first time, right? So he got fired at he literally was fired and ran off from his two previous police chief jobs, citing the same, the associations there cited the same exact problems that our association cited. And so I'm like, he's credible, but the person who literally handles our multi-million dollar budget, signs our paychecks, you know, pays all the vendors, like this person is not credible. But yeah, you're right, man. I mean, and even she said, because I recorded the conversation we had, she says, in my world, you know, we don't remove directors, especially police of chief of police, unless we think they're going to interfere in the investigation. I'm like, but if it was me or one of my coworkers, you would remove them. What's the difference? What makes him different? His master's degree?
No, and something, I mean, that you just jogged my memory on something, which is when I was talking on the on a different podcast with Whistleblower of the Week with Jane Turner. I was doing a follow up on my case, and something I said that resonated with Jane, and I think it fits here, is every police chief is a stakeholder in an investigation.
Absolutely,
every single one, and that's why with like the Lamplighter Project, one of the things we did was we helped sponsor House Resolution 6762, which it timed out, so like it couldn't get enough co-sponsors, but it should be reintroduced, as far as I know. But it was 2 years ago that we helped, or I'm sorry, last year that we helped contribute to that legislation, and it was a way to take internal affairs away from police departments as a whole. If you wanted federal funding, you were going to have to actually agree to this program that was going to allow for the Inspector General's office to create a system of external attorneys and investigators that were going to come in that were totally, and they had to be vetted and checked, that were not going to be attached to your police department.
Yeah, can't be weekend drinking buddies with the freaking police chief or the major.
That were going to be unbiased and take over internal affairs. And that truly, still to this day, is one of the only things I think would truly solve this problem. And maybe not.
Now, where's that at right now? Did it get...
So it got co-sponsors, but the problem was that it was right at the end of the like session-ish. There was all this other legislation they were voting on. And typically what I find with whistleblower legislation, because we've helped and we've also advocated for other industries like whistleblowers and their legislation. Like we recently endorsed one for private contractors for the federal government and their whistleblower rights. But with that one, same thing happens. It is so hard to push through whistleblower protections in the government. And this is at the federal level. We're not talking like a state Congress. We're talking, this is Washington, D.C. Like we're talking big, big players. And why? And the question is always, well, you know, this is we love whistleblowers and whistleblowers are important and we truly care. And what they do is so powerful, but like, don't talk about me. Like, and it's like, that's the problem. Right. So I can say that again, like I do think that one of the only ways to solve this, and I know a lot of this is a hot topic or a hot take, a lot of people won't agree with it, is we have to, if we can't fix internal affairs, we have to give it away. because it, and we can give it to people that are former cops. We can give it to people that do understand the space, because typically you're like, well, they're not cops. They don't get it.
Right.
Well,
you just have, like you said, you have to vet it out properly.
Yeah.
It can't be former cops of that agency.
Yep. They can't be connected. And that's the problem, is because in our case, and I know we're running short on time, so we may have to do another part, but I'll say that in our case, I lost my certification. I got it back. Still a certified officer now. I'm just not working. But the way I got it back was extremely hard. I had to fight mm-hmm. for my police certification, because like same thing as the Department of Labor. They're like, well, you know, the department presented this documentation, and then I submitted an appeal, and then that appeal also got denied. And I was like, well, I guess they're going to revoke my certification. And again, after all the news, after fighting so hard, I just got a very unexpected letter in the mail, like 2 years later, that said that they had administratively dismissed this case. And so I didn't know what that meant. And so I called, because the lieutenant that was targeting people in our department, he still has his active certification in Georgia, but because he resigned, but because I was terminated, I had to go under an automatic investigation.
And this is the lieutenant that was targeting the kids.
Yeah. And this is the one that we have the evidence of. And this is the one that people contacted me about and saying that. And so it's wild, because I had to fight so hard, and I was like, I don't know. But something I always told, and I've said it on every interview I've ever been on, I've said it on every podcast, and it came out of like a monologue we were filming in California, where someone asked me like, what would I say to my younger self going through this? And I said it, and I've said it in the Senate building this past summer. They can take your gun and they can take your badge, but they can never take away the fact that you're a cop. And you just chose to police the police, which is exactly what the public asked you to do. And I realized I had said that to probably 20, 30 different whistleblowers through the project, through different interviews and things. And when I got this letter and it was administratively dismissed, I actually called the headquarters, and the lady was like, I don't know what that means. I've never seen that on a letter. So you're gonna have to talk to the director of the certification board. And I was like, that sounds terrifying. But sure. Got the dude on the phone. He couldn't talk too much about it, but he was like, the director was like, well, that just means that, like, without giving you any details that are, you know, confidential to the board, that the board reevaluated your case and decided that you never should have lost it in the first place. So we're not giving it back to you retroactively in the sense of like, oh, well, now you're active again. They canceled it out as a whole, meaning like on records, I was always a certified officer. I never lost it. I just didn't know it yet. And so
that's pretty badass.
And so all those times I told cops, they can take your gun and take away, and they can take your badge, but they can never take away the fact that you're a cop. I was a cop and I didn't even know it. And that was what was such a powerful thing for me. And I try to use that as a good way to explain to people, like, you live this lifestyle, and whether you realize it or not, you know, once you're a cop, you will probably always walk in a very similar light. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be this toxic personality. It doesn't have to be this toxic lifestyle. It can be like, cause some people get out and they're like, I was a cop, and they just walk around. Like,
yeah,
it can be a part of your personality, and it doesn't have to be just associated with that uniform. You're still a cop through and through. You still check, and you still sit with your back in the corner, and you still check and make sure you can see everyone coming in the room, and you still do all the cop things probably for the rest of your life.
And you're going to protect people.
Yep.
You're going to protect those that are vulnerable, you know. It's not going to change.
Well, and that's how I took about 2 years, or I took about a year off of working. And then I went in and I did international disaster response and humanitarian aid with Team Rubicon. And I got to go to like Honduras. I got to assist while Team Rubicon was responding to Ukraine remotely. I got to stand where cities once stood that were just wiped away by tornadoes and floods. I got to do search and rescue, which technically isn't in Team Rubicon's job description, but they had no one else there to help find somebody that was lost in the rubble. We did find her. It was a recovery, unfortunately. But I got to do this, and that's something I talk about. I spoke at the Go Heroes conference in Dallas they canceled this year, but I did last year. And then I'll be hopefully the keynote speaker, as far as I know, next year. But in my segment, Rogue Blue, Beyond the Call of Duty, something that I talk about is people that have a life of service. You chose the life of service long before you picked a badge, a patch, a job title. You want to help and serve others, and it will always be a part of you.
natural born leaders, man.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I've always said this, you know, man, you can send people to all kinds of leadership training, you know, and I'm not saying it's bad. Clearly, I mean, people need self-development. They, you know, improvement. I understand that. But leaders are born, right? And a lot of times they just need cultivated. They need somebody to say, hey, like, give them an opportunity to spread their wings and to cultivate that leadership in that servant's heart that already exists within them, you know. And the problem is, in this profession of law enforcement, man, there's too many cowards. There's too many cowards that are not leaders. All they want is status, paycheck, because we all know we didn't get, you know, police work to get rich. But, true, you know, these people who promote up, who get into commander positions, at that point, it's just, you know, look at my LinkedIn, right? Like, look at my master's degree. look at this state leadership training that I've attended that's prestigious. Or I went to the FBI National Academy. I mean, I'm cool with all those things. I don't have a problem with those things, right? Yeah. But those don't make a person a freaking leader. No. A person who is a leader, they're born that way, man. And I've said it, like, some people disagree, but I don't think you can create a leader. I think you can just cultivate one, mm-hmm, and build them up. It's already there.
And I think that we have a culture, I think, in law enforcement of leaders, especially that are formerly they were leaders because they were relevant, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then they never wanted to update. They never wanted to do these things. And so they haven't changed. And so they still, if you catch them on a bad day, no matter how nice they may seem, you catch them on a bad day, it'll show.
Oh, yeah.
And the reality is that leadership also changes. And the public, you just because you're a leader doesn't mean you can lead everybody, but you can have the opportunity again to cultivate that, to lead different groups of people or to win people to your side. And then you realize really quickly when you start to do that, you realize that it's not a leadership problem. You realize that it's a people problem.
Right.
You don't know how to talk to people. You don't know how to actually gain someone's respect because you've been, I attended the FBI Academy. I did all these things, or I was a chief for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, which is wild to think about. That's when you forgot. That's when you forgot that it was a people thing. Because I guarantee you, when you were rising through the ranks, when you were a younger officer, you had to be a people person.
Yeah.
You had to play, because people call it playing the game. It doesn't have to be playing a game. It doesn't have to be something like that. It can be something so much bigger. It can be career building, because you can build a department and build a community just by simply talking to people. And I guarantee you that community will get behind you if you do it the right way, because you can change their mind. You can open their eyes to the realities of policing, but you got to learn how to talk.
And man, you know, you can also, when you meet somebody, like, we can go out downtown here and we can find 10 different cops. We can walk up to them and just start a conversation. You can tell very quickly.
Instantly.
Who is authentic and who is not.
Instantly.
I mean, it is, it's not hard. And that's what I don't understand about these agencies that hire these chiefs, or that elect these sheriffs. How can you not just, a lot of times people are worried about what's on the resume. Again, it's important, but forget the resume for a second. Take the resume away, because really and truly at the end of the day, as long as they have the basic qualifications and you know it, set that crap aside, because it doesn't matter anymore. At that point, it's talking to this person, asking him or her the right questions. What kind of person are you? And I think so many times, man, during these hiring processes, you know, everybody spends thousands and thousands of dollars to hire these firms to come in, and they're missing that part of it. They're taking the, you know, you talk about humanizing the badge. They're taking that away. they're just so focused on the wrong things. They're focused on the resume. They're focused on the school, the GPA, and they're missing. I mean, dude, this chief that was at Pilot Point, Rex Marks, they SRG, whatever that company is that does the national backgrounds, in an hour and a half deep diving Google, I found that the man was canned from two different agencies where the associations filed complaints on him for the same that our association filed. I mean, dude, you could take the documents of our association, the logo, and switch them, and you would have never known the difference. Mm-hmm. Same stuff. I found all these news articles. I found all this stuff. And the city of Pilot Point had no clue that this had happened. They just hired this guy willy-nilly because they were worried about the fact that, you know, he had this particular military service, or, you know, he was chief here, he was captain here, and, oh, look at this, he went to the National Academy, whatever it may, you know, fill in the blank. They were worried about all the wrong things, and they weren't worried about what kind of person he was, how he wanted to treat his officers, how he wanted to develop his officers and his organization. All those things just get missed. They get missed when these chiefs are getting hired, and it blows my mind, man. It really does. Why it's that way.
It speaks to an issue that you see inside governments as a whole, which is like when they're hiring an officer, it's very, sometimes very rigorous. They're like, you know, and I can tell you, cause I was contacted by an agency and asked to go through the process because I was a whistleblower and I was subjected to a 6-hour polygraph, which every question related to Dunwoody I passed. On the catch-all question, they said I was inconclusive. But I told him everything, and I told him that. And it's also later after that, and I made the case to you the other day, that, again, that people that go through the PTSD that I acquired at the city of Dunwoody by being falsely accused of things for months, when you're under that polygraph, it's probably a little fair that your heart rate's going to go up or you sweat a little bit when someone asks you, are you sure you told us everything? It's like, well,
let me think. Well, yeah, now I've got anxiety let me think for a minute.
Let me recall, because the last time I was this close to the job, I lost my identity for telling the truth. So let me think right now and make sure, because I really want the job, that I did tell you everything. And when you do that, they're like, well, you had to think about it. And like, you know, and so and every examiner's different, but it's like, and in those moments, it's like, you really truly like feel so different. But, and I even was measured for uniforms for them to go, well, that one question, you can apply again. And it was like, and the chief even knew, like, the chief's okay. He knows your whole story. You can't wait to hire you. And then it was like, that happened, or like, and that's the other issue, is you can have someone in the process along the way. And this is what I think truly happened. You can have someone in the process along the way, like a polygraph examiner. You can't always trust that a polygraph examiner is truly unbiased.
Exactly.
And especially when they told me to my face, they're like, you know what? Normally we use a civilian polygraph examiner, but because of your situation, we're going to use one of our detectives. And it's like, that's interesting.
And they want to find something.
Yes.
You know, instead of going into it completely, you know, objective, they want to find something.
And that was what was so wild. And I just remember, because I was like, and I told the dude, and I told you this, that I would leave disappointed if I didn't get the job, but I would leave still just like, be no sweat off my back, because it's like, I know I showed up, I tried, and I essentially had the job, and I told you everything, and I told you the truth, and I won't lose an ounce of sleep over it. And that dude did not like that answer. Because then if he truly did believe, like, oh, this is weird, like, is something different, like, maybe he did see it because of the trauma, maybe he did see those things, then if he truly thought that there was some indicator that something was wrong, now that breaks his whole worldview about polygraphs. So yeah. Now he's, you know, he's going to just stick with it. But then you go to a chief, or you go to a mayor, or you go to a city manager, or you go to a whoever. Oh, I really like that dude. That's who we're going to hire.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, his background's a little, I don't care. I talk to him. I like him. I trust him. I got a good feeling about him. And it's like, or her. And it's like, that's strange, because the officers are like, for me, 6 hours on a polygraph. I mean, to be fair, that wasn't always hooked up to me for the 6 hours, but the whole session.
But still, I mean, that's such a rigorous and stressful process, man. And I told you the other day how I felt about polygraphs. I do not think there's a reason why they're inadmissible in a court setting.
I mean,
I do not think they should be used for as hiring techniques. Because man, I think it's just, you got somebody in the hiring process. For example, a buddy of mine, he's a DPS trooper. He's a DPS trooper now, but he failed the polygraph the first time because he said he was selling drugs. So the prestigious Texas DPS, who, you know, it's revered by everybody, cowboy hat wearing prestigious law enforcement of the entire state. You think this guy was selling drugs? Okay, you failed. See us again in 6 months. Comes back later in 6 months. Same exact polygraph, same exact questions, but he passes. You can't tell me that you right there scientifically says there's something wrong with this process. There's something wrong with this test. And why those are still being used, I've been totally against polygraphs for the longest time, man, because I've seen multiple officers over my 15-year career just not get jobs, not get positions, just simply because they failed a polygraph test. And we all know that they're just not accurate. But you can't say that to a polygrapher. That's like a cardinal sin to... Okay.
It's like a cult.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you literally are not allowed... Like, it's... It reminds me of a stand-up I was watching the other day where it's like when you're the one person at the pool that's not in the pool, but as soon as someone enters the pool, it's like a cult because everyone that's in the pool is like, come, get in the pool. And they're like, their whole mission in life is to get you to get in the pool too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly like polygraphers are saying. Like, they'll go through it. They'll be like, and I guarantee you, before they even go, they're like, they're skeptical of it. And then they attend that thing and they come out of that brainwashing and they're like, this is the end-all, be-all, will save humanity.
This is the gold standard for hiring.
People will walk out of there and be like, I'm going to use it on my wife. Like, it's insane. And like, but what's so funny about it is like, even just the other day, or maybe like a couple weeks ago, Tucker Carlson and Chris Cuomo, two total polar opposites.
I watched that.
And Chris Cuomo himself said it during his interview to Tucker. He said, about talking about the polygraph, he said, I'll take a polygraph. I know how to beat the test. And it's like, if we like, and that's the general consensus because there are people that can, there are plenty of people that can, that are just actually like psychopaths, especially who don't actually have a bodily reaction or a sociopath. And so like they can go in and beat those tests and those people can make it on the job because that is what we consider our bastion, our last line.
Well, you sit them in a room kind of like yours for 6 hours. You're already stressed. Then they ask you the question. Are you sure you didn't tell us about, or you told us about this? And you're like, oh, I don't remember. And then, I mean, it's just an anxiety ridden experience. I've had three or four of them. And I had one for an IA one time that had nothing to do with me, but they put me on a polygraph. And dude, it was just so, I mean, it was exhausting. I was sweating, dude. My shirt was soaked when I walked out of there because it was just so nerve wracking. But they'll want to do that rather than sit down with somebody and have a full on real face to face conversation with somebody for 6 hours rather than hooking them up to a freaking machine or pinning the polygraph report up on the wall and saying, you know, when I did mine years ago, they printed it and they stuck it on the wall and they had the little pointer and they said, well, what were you thinking about right here? And you see it spiked. And I was like, you know, and why not sit down and have an authentic conversation with these people? Cause I'm telling you, man,
I left the oven on.
Yeah. Like, I mean, cause you think about the craziest stuff when they ask you that catch all question, like, you know, is there anything that you're not telling us here today? And you're like, one of my questions was I had sex in the, so when I was 17, they asked me, they said, have you ever committed any undetected sexual acts? And so when they asked me that polygraph, I was 18 years old and I was going to work in the jail at Bedford. And when they asked me that question, I immediately was like, oh. And I thought of the time that I had sex in the park with my girlfriend when I was like 16 or 17. And I thought of it. And I was like, because they tell you, don't say yes or no. Or you can only say, excuse me, you can only say yes or no. There's nothing else you can say. And I'm sitting there like, no, I didn't tell you everything. And so he stops and he's like, well, this really spiked up. What were you thinking about? And I said, man, I was thinking about the fact that I had sex in the park. I forgot to tell you guys. Oh, you know, and they were like, they let it go. You know, they but it's things like
it's
that.
By choice. With it's those, by choice with, they let
yes,
it go.
It's by choice. If they didn't like me, right? Like if they had to go through the motions, like they couldn't DQ me for anything else, and I got to the polygraph, and there was somebody in that agency that didn't like me, or they heard something wrong, you know, bad about me that they didn't like, but they couldn't DQ it on paper, they would take that and be like, oh, yeah, sorry, man. You know, you didn't disclose that in your, you know, 87-page packet, so you're out. And it is, man. It's all just crazy how the law enforcement profession is supposed to be one of just high integrity, morals, doing what's right, and it's the worst profession on the planet for doing the opposite, for misconduct, for corruption, and just guiding the system, guiding the processes to whatever you want it to be, the people that control those out. And same with government. I mean, you look at the national stage. I mean, look at who's controlling what, but it's crazy, man.
Well, and it really is, because like there's a case right now that the project had that someone has asked for us to talk about, so I can talk about it. But the project hasn't actually intervened or done anything on her case yet. But we have talked to this person. But there's a case here in Texas, north of Dallas, and she was subjected to a polygraph after she spoke out about stuff happening in their department. They created a paper trail on her. She wanted to whatever. Someone filed a complaint. Because typically that's one of the best ways for a department to get you is if the public just happens to file a complaint on somebody, which they do pretty frequently on different people. You could just be the wrong officer at the wrong time and that person just was waiting to file a complaint on somebody. Yeah. Like he just – that there's people like that. And thing happened to her, and so they brought her in. They're like, well, we heard this and she said that, and so we're going to put her through a polygraph and you. And they put her through the polygraph and it came back good. But before, as far as I know, it came back good. But before the polygraph results came back from the other person, they went ahead and fired her. Why? Because the person she was speaking out about was a school resource officer who's best friends with one of the
I was going to say, chief. I already knew there was some sort of connection.
Yeah, I mean, and so it's like, again, like these officers that are going into these misconduct investigations, I would encourage other officers to like not just immediately assume that they actually did something wrong, because their fate a lot oftentimes is sealed before they ever enter that room, before they ever sign their Garrity rights, before they ever do anything like that. And it's insane to me because a lot of times, and I think we're short on time, but I'll finish with talking about the Garcetti rule. Do you know what the Garcetti rule is?
Mm-mm.
No, yeah, and that's the thing that they don't talk about in police departments everywhere, but it affects all of us. The Garcetti rule is something we talked about with the USA Today special. Or series, and written by Daphne Durrett, by the way. Shout out to Daphne. Phenomenal person. So the Garcetti rule is very similar. A lot of people confuse it for Garrity, except for it's from a case that the Supreme Court has already ruled on from years ago. And this is a short version, and it's probably all kinds of messed up, so don't quote me on the exact facts. But
look it up.
Essentially, yeah, right? Yeah, fact checked. So essentially this guy was an officer or a deputy, and so he went and he's observed something. They brought him in to do to testify in court about what he witnessed, but it was for a different agency. It was for another agency, whatever he witnessed or whatever. Long story short, and I'm going to even simplify it even more so that way I don't misspeak, but this dude goes up there and says what he saw. What he testifies in court because he was asked and subpoenaed by court to show up in court and to testify. He shows up and he testifies to what he saw happen at the other department. But his own department didn't like what he said. And so they fired him, saying that you're not allowed to say those things. Like you don't actually have freedom of speech here as an officer. And we don't agree with you going, even though you were subpoenaed to go and to testify. Goes to the appeals court. The appeals court rules in the officer's favor and says that he has freedom of speech.
Absolutely.
He had his a legal obligation to be there and to go and to testify in court. And he spoke the truth. He spoke the truth. And they fired him again, just fired him because it was a work at will kind of thing.
Of course, at will.
So goes to the Supreme Court, almost split decision, 5-4. They decide that police officers do not have freedom of speech because it's in your job description. Anything that's in your job description as a police officer that you can be paid for, that you can do on the job, you do not have like freedom of speech. And so since testifying in court is under your job description, under the Garcetti rule, you do not have freedom of speech. It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
That makes no sense, man.
So you can be fired for anything you testify. Anything.
Yeah.
That you testify, true or false, you can be fired.
What year was this in the, do you remember? Do you
know? Not off the top of my head, but I can't, it's still active. So House Resolution 6762 was our effort to overturn the Garcetti rule. Because by taking internal affairs away, it would have made it possible to where they couldn't fire you, because we had some stuff in 6762 that made it so that way they couldn't retaliate against you after you spoke out. Like there was, essentially it moved you out of the command structure as a whole. But that's the problem. And the most officers don't even know about the Garcetti rule. They have no idea that you can be fired for this. So what you saw in police departments across the country is the same thing. And it happens everywhere. And this is typically how I explain to lamplighters where do they start their progress or process and all this in their own stories is you with the Garcetti rule, you probably have a policy somewhere in your department that says you have a duty to report misconduct when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen a policy that says you have a duty to investigate misconduct?
I can't think of one.
Well, guess what? Because that's in your policy, you can be fired for reporting misconduct and work at Will States. And that's insane.
See, there's always got to be a catch-all. That way, and that's what they go to.
And they can,
they go to the catch-all.
They can fire you for not reporting misconduct, but they can also fire you for reporting valid, true, accurate misconduct. And that is the problem with our system, is because you can be fired for sneezing. You can be fired if someone just doesn't like you. You can be fired for like whatever they want. And I understand the whole concept of work at Will States. But the problem is when you're in like such a profession as policing, is it's too temperamental to even imagine.
Yeah, I think as far as at will, when it comes to policing law enforcement, I don't think that should apply. Because man, there's just so much. I mean, look what they got you for, allegedly speeding in your patrol car. And I mean, that is just so,
it was just such,
it's disheartening, man. It is. So, before we wrap it up, I want you to, we've talked about lamplighter, but we haven't like actually talked about it. So explain what it is, explain how officers, like what resources you guys have and how they can get in touch with, the lamplighter and how you became a part of it.
Sure. Yeah. And before I do that, let me double back to say one thing. That I learned from a whistleblower advisor who now teaches at the Naval War College, who reached out to me and gave me some advice a couple of years ago. To any officer that's out there, any law enforcement officer that is going through this, I encourage you to open your employee handbook, not your SOP, your employee handbook or your city handbook, whatever, your county, and find like page 5, 6, whatever, the first actual policy is in there, or statement. It's probably an ethics statement.
Mm-hmm.
It's most likely an ethics statement. It's probably written somewhere along the lines of, we will put our city first, or our citizens first, or we will, you know, protect them at all costs, or whatever it says, you know, whatever jargon they use. Well, if you are a layman and you have no legal background, no legal training, and you were to open that handbook and read it and say, these are the rules of you working here. This is your handbook. Rule number one, long before you ever got your SOP and you're reading it, most people without legal training would agree that the way it's written and the fact that it's at the front of the book, it makes it the most important policy in the book. And with that thought process is how we've overturned several cases. Because ethics comes first.
Yeah.
And it is the most important thing in your handbook. So everything else is subject to that ethics statement. And if you can show that you were truly putting the public first, that you were truly putting your job or your agency first, or putting that citizen first in that situation, and that means you had to go against the other policies to do it, you can be protected. You might have to fight for it.
Oh yeah, you're going to fight.
But
there's always going to be a fight.
Yeah, yeah. So I just want to throw that out there, because it's one of the most pretty powerful tools I think I've given to a lot of our lamplighters. But so the Lamplighter Project, yeah, it started as a support group. It started with that lieutenant that reached out to me from up north. And that he listened to my whole story. And then he told me the most powerful thing I'd ever heard at the time, because I was really feeling down. I was like 6 months into my fight. He said that, I just want to tell you one thing, that it sounds like you were a good cop, and that never should have happened to you. And that just gave me so much energy to keep fighting. And we kept up, and he actually started sending me a few people. And through my TikTok taking off, at that point, I think I had like 100,000 followers or something. And I started getting messages from cops all over the country, And I think that's like when Frank Serpico followed me on Twitter. Like it was, which I have like no followers on Twitter, but Frank Serpico does follow me so, as of today. So then all of a sudden I was out traveling. I got a call while I was in Alaska and he said, "Hey, I think I'm going to make this thing into a nonprofit. Do you want to make it a formalized thing? And will you be on the board one day?" And I said, "Sure." And so we started throwing it together a couple of years ago. We had some trouble really starting in the sense of like, we are all super busy.
Yeah. It's hard to run a nonprofit, man.
So finally this past year, we classified it as we actually got our certification or our official certificate as a 501c3 nonprofit. We've run it as a support group for a while, but now and advocating for change and legislation, but now it's official. So we can take donations on our website and you can find our website at thelamplighterproject.org. But on there, you'll see that you have me as the vice chairman. You have our chair of the board, Sarah Thompson, who is a Peace Corps whistleblower. We figured she was probably made the most sense to be in charge of us on the board.
That's badass.
Because she was the only one that is not a cop. And so, but she did. She fought for legislation. She found out that the Peace Corps was giving a drug knowingly to their volunteers years ago that was making them sick because it saved them money. And it's causing disease and all kinds of things. And she fought for legislation and she lost. She lost, but the one thing that she did win was she won back herself and she kept fighting. And now she works with us. She works with organizations around the country, as far as I know. And she's an amazing human being. Our secretary is Norman Carter, who wrote a book, My Long Blue Walk. And he was a Philly cop, spoke out about how the Philly police, and this is a very short version of a very long story. He spoke out about how the Philly police, every time that people were putting in requests for people to check their houses when they were out of town, like vacation, like home checks or whatever, that the Philly police were knowingly burglarizing the homes themselves, knowing that the people were out of town and then leaving case cards saying, "Hey, yeah, your house was broken into while you were gone. We don't know what happened."
That's wild right there, man.
And that's wild. It was only one district or zone in Philly. And he took that zone as a retirement zone. It was like a residential zone. Like he'd already been a cop for like 20, 30 years. And so he was like, "That's what I'm going to go do." And then he found that, spoke out against it. And then our director, Jeremiah Johnson, who, wasn't even able to release his name until recently because of the nature of whistleblowing and how dangerous it can be. And he was in law enforcement at the time still. And I know now that now he's the deputy commissioner over the Department of Corrections for New York. And he is still our active executive director. But, he was going through the same thing. He for some reason didn't initially consider himself a lamplighter, but he really truly was, because he spoke out in his own department about administrative things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people don't understand that that does make you a whistleblower.
That's a lamplighter. That's the thing, man. People sitting out here listening, you know, I want to encourage, because, you know, you may say, "Well, my case doesn't involve a lieutenant to, you know,
or a drug ring."
Right. There's all, your story is your story. Misconduct is misconduct, no matter what level it's on, you know? And the whole point, I mean, whistleblowers, I hope that people find encouragement through this conversation, through this podcast, because there's so many good cops out there that are afraid, man. And it sucks because we sit here and tell our story. Yeah, we've been fired. You know, we've gone through 3 years of litigation, whatever. It is a battle. Right? It is a battle. And sometimes you don't win when it comes to, like, in court. Sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
But what you said was, you know, they could take away your job, they could take away this, but, you know, the fact that you stood up to police the police, you know, they can't take that away. At the end, whether you lose in court and our judge or a jury says, "Nah, you know, you ain't got it," that doesn't mean that, you know, truth is still truth.
Yeah. And I'll finish with just this quick kind of explainer too, which is our website. We use a service called FlokiNet, which was designed for whistleblowers. And so it bounces your IP address all over the place and stuff. So I really, like, administratively, we can't really track who is coming to our website and stuff. We do have the typical like website cookies. So if we really truly wanted to, we could see like where, what area, maybe a state someone's in, but we have a system set up. So whenever you access our form for intake, it uses FlokiNet. So we can't see where you are when you submit the form. You can use an alias. You can use a fake phone number if you want.
That's amazing. Email,
and you can write your narrative and we'll reach out to you. And we do get a lot that come in waves. It's strange. But we will reach out to you and just try to get a phone call with you or an email going to like give you some resources or just some thoughts or just to listen to your story. Because one of the most important things I've ever realized in several cases, that's really all they needed to win their fight was literally me listening to them and being honest listening to their entire story, asking some hard questions along the way and then going, you know, that shouldn't have happened to you. And there's been a couple along the way that I've had to be like, hey man. And those people still hit me up. They were like, that was still like, I just needed to tell somebody and I truly appreciate it. And you're right. I was wrong. I appreciate that, man. But like the reality is like, we're not just going to like listen to this, you know, whistleblower story and be like, yeah, it's totally true. Like we do also like try to ask these hard questions and validate and ask like, you know, it's not always as simple as they didn't like me. They didn't want me to be there. They violated like the law. Like it's not that simple. And then the last thing I think I have about the project is that I can tell you that we've impacted over 20 states. I can tell you that we've worked cases from NYPD all the way out to California. I can tell you that we've spoken to, I personally, by request of them, thanks to TikTok, our project has very slightly, assisted people that worked in the mounted police in Canada. So I had a message to me on TikTok from police in Brazil that said they loved what we were doing, which seems very concerning because Brazil is super corrupt. But it was super nice because across the world, really across the globe, people truly know that this is a problem. And our brothers and sisters in blue across the globe want to fix it. They know it's a problem. And it's not just here.
Yeah.
The Royal Mounted Police, they told her she could never contact me again. That's insane. And all we did was listen to her.
Yeah.
She had to reach out to me through a third party that just retired to tell me that.
Well, I'm so glad, man, that I remember somebody, I told you this, somebody reached out to me during my, I don't know how they found me, but somebody found me from Lamplighter when I was going through my stuff in Palestine. And I just thought it was super cool. And then a couple years later, we connect, which I find super interesting. But for all the cops out there listening, you know, just know that there's people out there, you know, failing justice. We're here for you too. You know, somebody messaged me the other day and said, man, you talk a lot of negative stuff about cops. And, you know, we're a very broad platform. We talk about a lot of things. We talk about good, bad, ugly. I believe, and that's how Failing Justice was born, was out of corruption and misconduct and me speaking out and starting this podcast and sitting down and bringing people in here and letting them tell their stories. Because I truly think sometimes, not all the time, but a lot of times, going public with your story is safer. And that's why I asked you that earlier. For me, it's happened that way and for a lot of other people. So I just want to encourage people to, even if you don't want to come public, you know, reach out to Failing Justice, reach out to the Lamplighter. You should talk about your TikTok. So how do people find you on there?
Yeah. So you can find me at officer.ash, A-S-H. Those are my initials. A lot of people ask why, because back when I first started it, I didn't have a dot, like a period between officer and ash. So sometimes when you read it fast, it looked like office rash. So
office rash.
So I had to rebrand myself back in like 2020, but
that's cool. It's
officer.ash. And that's on TikTok and Instagram. And then I think it maybe has a dash on Twitter, which I really only use to really just kind of get messages across to the city whenever we're working on stuff related to our case and stuff, since we still can. But, so I'm rarely on Twitter, but TikTok is definitely the best way to catch up on my story. You'll see series on there. You'll see all kinds of other officers' stories. And you'll probably see a little bit of just my daily life. I mean, as it's grown, it's kind of become like my side personality. Yeah. So it's kind of like I have to also be myself sometimes. And sometimes like you might just see me just posting a video to post it. Like, but most of it is pretty all about policing and stuff. And so, or just corruption and whistleblowers and trying to uplift others and our own story. But I do want to say, and this can be my promise, my final comment here, which is to those people that are like reaching out to you, is like, man, you talk a lot of negative stuff about cops. Some of my most viral videos is reaction videos to people like that were cops that don't believe other cops can be bad, or that, you know, you just got fired because you were caught speeding.
Exactly, man.
You were fired for lying. I looked it up, and it's like, okay, well, if you actually look Google Dunwoody police corruption, you'll find about 30 news articles that will tell you how deep this goes. And you'll find several that will tell you that I didn't lie. But here's the kicker. My most viral videos were videos where I reacted to people's comments. And one of them was backstabbing traitor.
Mm.
Don't listen to those comments, man, because they're going to come. They're going to come but it's our job to open up people's eyes and help them to understand that cops, I still truly believe, are inherently good, but we have to help them continue to hold that high caliber of ethics. And that's up to us to do, is to help them to understand that it's okay to feel stressed, pressed, and even depressed about it. And it's okay to talk about your feelings. It's okay to talk about the misconduct you're experiencing. It's okay to stand up for what you believe in.
Yeah. And to that, I also want to say, those that are out there, that I have a pretty large following, man, of people that don't like cops. And, you know, I've told people multiple times, like, I understand those feelings and emotions. I do come down to that level and understand that, because there was a period of time where I didn't like cops after I was. And so to those that, you know, have ill feelings towards the police, you know, just think of, I hope our conversation was very eye opening, because sometimes, man, cops just deal with a lot of things, and maybe they're battling, trying to speak up against, you know, misconduct or corruption or whatever the case may be. And give them a break, you know, realize that the job's hard and not the easiest thing in the world to do. And I think that giving them a little grace sometimes goes a long way. Austin, I really appreciate you being here. Maybe I get you on again sometime, man. I think we had really good, authentic conversation. And I'm very glad that you decided to join the Failing Justice podcast. So, yeah, I appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me, man. It was a good time.
And just remember, y'all follow him on his social media. Remember, failingjustice.org. We're on all social media platforms. The @ failing one justice. That's the number one. And we appreciate everybody for listening in. Share this episode. Tell your friends about it. Tell your family. And if you know anybody that's been affected, you know, negatively or even in a positive route, manner in any kind of way in the legal system, reach out. We're always looking for people to come on the show. And so thanks for tuning in, and we will see you guys next time.
It's not just an organization. It's a call to action. Join us on this journey. Satisfaction. Dismantle barriers, build with passion. For a future where justice is not a fraction. Nah. Yeah, failing justice. Yeah, failing justice. Yeah, failing justice. Failing justice. Failing justice.